Continued. Number 20, Doe versus Occidental College. The panel in this case is Justice Siegel, Judge Stone, and me, which is why Justice Feuer left.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon. You're getting to be one of our frequent flyers.
I'll take the mileage, Your Honor. Mark Hathaway, on behalf of petitioner, I'd like to address the limitations on the independent judgment review of evidence under 1094.5 that's imposed by FACUDA and the requirements of Bixby. Then I'd like to discuss briefly the failure of the college adjudicator to bridge the analytical gap between the raw evidence and the ultimate decision and the policy, which is required by Topanga. And then third, the lack of evidence, the lack of substantial evidence to support the two critical findings in the adjudicator's decision. I think we've briefed it well, but there's additional points regarding the limitations that are imposed by that are imposed on independent review of the evidence under 1094.5. Those limitations come by way of FACUDA and also Bixby, which limit those limitations are based upon the separation of powers and on the official duty presumption under what is now Evidence Code 664. There is no justification for the court to treat any private litigant as a co-equal branch of the government and thereby defer and presume that the decisions of the private corporation are somehow correct. There's no foundation for that in FACUDA or in Bixby, and although Pomona College case and Gupta versus Stanford has applied 1094.5 to college disciplinary decisions at private colleges and universities, there's been no application that the official duty presumption applies to any private employee of a private entity, or that there's some reason to believe that deference should be given by a court to one private litigant over the other. And there are none of the existing case law that would require to be disturbed. Doe versus Regents, the San Diego case from 2016, which went into some great lengths describing what substantial evidence is. That is a public university. The employees are generally considered public employees. Public operated as a public trust. The California State University is authorized by the legislature by statute and is essentially a governmental agency. But there's no agency existence for, in this case, Occidental College or any of the other, I think there's several, 1,500 or so institutions in California affecting some 520,000 students. None of those students are going to, or decisions made about them are going to be made by a government agency that's entitled to those requirements, to deference. There was a case, I think, by this panel, 28, the cheating case, Doe versus USC, which talks about substantial evidence that's the test. But in that case, sanctions were an F instead of a B or an A, and that's not the kind of permanent damage or substantial sanction that's imposed for a student who's going to be suspended for a long period of time or by expulsion. Yes, ultimately, but that then that's correct. But then, okay, so then That, I correct myself. That would require this panel to reconsider or reconsider the issues in that case in light of the points here, which is there's no justification for the deference to a private entity. Even in Bixby, where the court is required to look to see if there's a vested fundamental right, that exists because of the limitations in place by FACUDA, essentially, by the separation of powers and the official duty presumption. So the Supreme Court has recognized that there are circumstances where the right that is affected is so precious and valuable that it's a vested fundamental right that the court has to actually look, and in those cases, they have to, they're not limited and required to look at the evidence using their independent judicial, under independent judicial review, essentially a trial de novo. Then I'd like to just address the adjudicator's decision and the lack of any connection, analytical connection, between the raw evidence and her ultimate decision. And this concerns first the determination, I think we all agree, both students were drunk. Chain was exhibiting every conceivable, but she was exhibiting all the behavior of someone consenting to sexual activity. It's probably one of the best documented circumstances of consensual sexual activity between students that are intoxicated that could exist. We have her before texting, asking for a condom. That only makes sense if there had been an agreement before to come back to have sex. She has sex in the room. I don't want to go over the facts again, but then she leaves, and even after that she goes and she's happy elsewhere in another dorm, exuberant. So the question is, was she was incapacitated at the time that she was actually, as the adjudicator found, actually exhibiting all the indications of consent by her conduct, by her actions, by her texting, by her behavior. And what she concludes is that her removal of her shirt while dancing, that she wouldn't normally do that, that that somehow means that she was incapacitated, and that affected her decision-making ability, and she was not aware of the consequences of her actions, and that she somehow didn't appreciate the consequences of her actions. But that's not what the policy requires. The policy states that, does she understand the who, what, when, why, or how of the sexual activity? And there's every indication at every moment, almost contemporaneous texts to her friends. She throws up. She even comes in and asks for gum, indicating that she's aware of her circumstances, where she is, that she wants, that she's just thrown up, that she wants to be presentable, that she wants to do something with her breath, that she knows what activity is going to continue. And it's only the later not quite remembering the sexual intercourse. Now, she remembers the oral sex, and that's apparently consensual because she remembers it. But the investigator doesn't connect those findings on 664 that she was incapacitated at the time she's doing everything she can to indicate consent. And then the next point is that she talks about the whether the respondent knew or should have known, and she creates a requirement that's not in the policy that says she's supposed to determine what a sober respondent would have done. And she lists essentially the same few points. But a sober person, seeing that she had vomited, doesn't indicate anything about capacity and incapacity. She was swigging vodka in her room, but he didn't know what she had done before. She was dancing exuberantly. She was slurring her speech. And the key, and I think at the trial court, was talking about ripping off the shirt. There's no ripping off the shirt. It doesn't exist anywhere in the record. She took her shirt off. But even that How would anybody who just met her know that that's not her usual behavior? Those do not indicate to a sober individual, and plus, I think this shows, all that the adjudicator did was look at the substantial evidence that supports her finding. She doesn't balance or weigh the evidence. She herself is doing a substantial evidence test to support the initial allegations that there was a lack of consent. She doesn't weigh the sober person getting a text that says, do you have a condom? She doesn't weigh any of the behavior or the conversation that they had in the room. It only makes sense that they had that behavior because of the text messages. She doesn't weigh anything. And if the court never looks at whether there's preponderance of evidence to support a finding, and the adjudicator at the school level never looks, then the student would never be in a position to have a court overturn a decision. There's always going to be substantial evidence. I think Doe versus UC San Diego makes that clear. There's always going to be some type of substantial evidence that supports some sort of finding. And here there's simply the adjudicator did not connect the dots between the raw data of taking off the shirt, dancing exuberantly, swigging alcohol in light of the requirements of the policy, which merely state, which require that someone lack, this is the notice that Occidental is giving their students, do you lack the who, what, where, why, or how of the sexual interaction? It's there at every step of the way. She understands where she is, where she's going. She had to walk to get there. I think it was very clear in the briefing. I'd also want to point out the adjudicator completed this, finished this in one, not even one working day. The hearing was on Saturday, December 7th, 2013, and this was the results was prepared, and the report was provided on Monday, December 9th. It's almost as if the adjudicator, having access to all the records and the reports, prepared something ahead of time and then made a few minor changes in light of the evidence. Unless the court has any questions, I'll reserve the balance of time for a rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. May it please the court. I will respond briefly, if I may, to the arguments of appellant that have just been identified here, and then I have a few other points to address. First, the standard of review. The court now, across a number of its divisions and in other districts as well, has a long line of consistent cases applying the substantial evidence test on mandamus review. It's not an issue of private corporations or public entities. It's the fact that in this kind of proceeding, a petition that appellant filed, he comes to the court on mandamus review. That is a limited proceeding. That is a proceeding in which the court does not have anything other than the administrative record generally to review. No live witness testimony like the administrative adjudicator had. So by its nature, only a limited review can and should be conducted, as the precedent acknowledges, unless there is an extraordinary circumstance of a vested fundamental right. Going back to Gerfinkel and the line of cases, in the academic context, the law is consistent. There is no fundamental vested right to a private college education. Therefore, on mandamus review of a petition for mandamus, substantial evidence is the standard, and of course de novo for a review of fair hearing and fairness. And that is a very well-established precedent now that applies to this case as well. In terms of the analytical gap that counsel refers to, as was the case at the trial court level, counsel here, an appellant, essentially go through a simple selective cherry-picking of certain facts. Of course, on substantial evidence review, the court examines all of the evidence that supports the administrative decision to determine whether a reasonable adjudicator could have reached the result, and only if a reasonable adjudicator could not have, on the supportive evidence in the record, should the court disturb the administrative finding. Appellant doesn't confront any of the evidence that supports the finding, and the record is replete with that, as is the adjudicator's decision. Just by way of example, Jane Roe herself testified at the live hearing that she was severely intoxicated to the point of being unconscious and blacking out, that she could not make decisions and that she was not coherent, that she was a virgin, a minor, that she regarded sex a serious matter and would never have chosen to have sex with John Doe if she had been capable of making a choice. She couldn't remember what had occurred in many material respects, and she was shocked to learn that, in fact, John Doe had sex with her. Now, this evidence alone is enough to dispose of this issue on substantial evidence review of a mandamus decision. As the court noted in the Doe versus Regents decision, the testimony of a single witness, even that of a party, is sufficient to provide substantial evidence to support a finding of fact. But Roe's testimony in the underlying hearing was also bolstered by substantial uncontradicted evidence from disinterested third-party witnesses, and we don't hear about that much from the appellant in his arguments in this appeal. These witnesses, the material statements of whom are analyzed and summarized at length in the administrative decision, testify that that Jane Roe was incoherent, stumbling, unable to speak, unable to be understood, couldn't swallow, was dribbling water out of her mouth, was very incapacitated, past drunk, and numerous other indicia of incapacitation. And these witnesses provided these observational evidence statements with respect to their observations close in time to the intercourse, both before and after.
Mr. Doe, shall we call him, was pretty drunk also, wasn't he?
John Doe did say that he was intoxicated, and that was supported by a number of witnesses as well.
Didn't he also lack capacity to consent? So that a reasonable person had Ms. Roe, I'm trying to remember Doe or Roe, Ms. Roe, was also not capable, he was also not capable of giving consent?
Theoretically, it's possible that both parties to a sexual contact
isn't
might
that
be
pretty much what happened here.
No, not at all. In fact, exactly the opposite. First of all, and most importantly, John Doe never made any claim in this administrative proceeding that he was incapacitated. And if the court will give me a minute to find the specific reference, he specifically said, "I was not incapacitated," during the hearing. He was very explicit about that. He was not incapacitated. Now, he also challenged the capacity of the alleged incapacity of Jane Roe. But at all times during this administrative hearing, John Doe was clear that he had capacity even though he was highly intoxicated. In fact, that was his essential position, was that both sides had capacity because I was intoxicated, but I had capacity, and she was intoxicated and must have been operating the same way. Of course, she was younger than him. She was 5'2". Her physiology was a lot different. And she was behaving very differently, according to the witnesses. Not much younger, yes. Although, as a legal matter, maybe there's some significance to being under 18. There wasn't in the administrative proceeding, of course. But the point is that the policy was equally available to John Doe. He could have asserted that he was incapacitated and, in theory, brought a complaint. He did not do so in this administrative proceeding. And in fact, he was express in the hearing itself that he was not incapacitated. He said that explicitly. So that was just not
the case. If the college knows of two people, does it need a complaint? If it knows of two people who are so drunk they can't give capacity, and no one brings neither one of the two individuals bring a claim, sorry, a complaint. Does the school do nothing, or if do they, in other words, what's the policy?
Yes, Justice Siegel, the school takes that into account expressly and within its own policy.
Take what into account?
The fact that intoxication may run both ways and may play a role within the determination process. It's memorialized explicitly in the policy. The policy requires that there be a finding that the respondent knew or should have known that is evaluated.
No, that wasn't my question. My question is if there's no complaint, but the school learns about a bunch of drunk freshmen having sex with each other and maybe not having capacity, do they do anything without a complaint or do they wait for a complaint? There's a lot of alcohol at Occidental College. Seems to be very young people drinking a lot of alcohol with the college not doing very much about it. So my question is if they come upon information, do they act on it or do they wait for a complaint?
The college does not necessarily wait for a complaint, and that's not the way the policy works, operates, or frankly how the law operates. That's not required. Of course, when it's addressing a complaint, it's not necessarily going to go look for other potential transgressions or violations that occurred. It's going to be focused its attention on adjudicating and complying with its policy and obligations regarding the student who's bringing the complaint in front of it. But the respondent's intoxication, while under the policy does not provide a defense in and of itself for obvious reasons, it was taken into account here, and the adjudicator's decision notes that and takes it into account. Since it would be a defense to any number of these cases, the fact that you were intoxicated is not under the policy a defense. You have a responsibility. I mean, ultimately, the college is responsible, and this isn't unique to Occidental, and neither is alcohol consumption as well. And that's not limited to colleges either. It's arguably a broader social problem that goes well beyond the academic environment. But when you have a circumstance where both sides, where there is an intoxicating situation for both, you have to have a process to resolve what happened, and to have that process be fair and to give both sides an opportunity to be heard. That's what the law requires.
So Mr. Doe could have said, I was not incapacitated, right? I was drinking a lot, but I can handle it. And the adjudicator could say, I don't believe you. I think you were incapacitated. And then also taken disciplinary action against Ms. Rowe, right? Because she had sex with someone who, in my hypothetical, would have been found to be incapacitated.
Obviously, a situation like that is hypothetical. I'm not sure.
Not that far from this case, but slightly hypothetical. He was drinking a lot, and he denied being incapacitated. But certainly Uri would be incapacitated with the amount of alcohol that the evidence suggests he was drinking.
He was expressed that he had capacity.
Right, but if you disbelieve that statement, all you're left with is the alcohol.
Well, you'd have to disbelieve his entire position in the entire matter. Remember,
of course.
You just heard appellate's counsel say that evidence of capacity, so much so that you should overturn an administrative decision on mandamus substantial evidence review, was demonstrated by text messages. Well, he was on the other side of those text messages and texting back and forth. He was expressed in the case at all times that he had capacity. So, yes, theoretically, could the college have decided that, and the adjudicator had decided that that one party who was claiming capacity was incapacitated? Theoretically, that's possible. Not really justifiable on the record here, given the position and the arguments that were made. The behavioral reaction by both students was totally different to the recognition of what happened. The interaction with their friends and other third-party witnesses was totally different. Her reaction was consistent with incapacity being violated and not giving consent. His was not. All of that, of course, if the issue of his capacity is in issue on a complaint of sexual assault by him, would undoubtedly be determined, according to the fair process, by the college and in accordance with his policy. That wasn't before the adjudicator here. Doesn't mean it was totally outside the adjudicator's purview, but not really supported by the record. Look, at the end of the day, a private college or university is entitled to set its rules for standards and conduct. Those rules and standards include sexual misconduct and the role that alcohol can play in those issues. Occidental's policy is quite explicit as to that and lays that out in policies that are available to every student. No one is required to enroll at Occidental. When someone enrolls, they consent to comply with and be subject to its policies. And those policies say that those policies warn explicitly about the risks of intoxication and advise students that it's especially important as a member of the Occidental community to understand the intoxication level of anyone with whom you would enter into sexual conduct. That's correct, and in fact, that's exactly correct, Justice Siegel. In fact, several of the witnesses referred to the training that they had had just weeks or days before these incidents occurred. In fact, witness three, that's why they were keeping an eye on her. And keep in mind the evidentiary circumstances here on substantial evidence review and what essentially appellant's position is at a very bottom line level. Everyone around Jane Roe is concerned about her. The evidence is consistent on that. There are people trying to pull her out of his room, to stop her multiple times from drinking vodka directly from a large bottle, checking in on her, putting her to bed, bringing her back, literally holding her up and walking her back to her room. All these people, five, six witnesses, are worried about her, checking her for alcohol poisoning, holding her hair back as she's vomiting before having sex. By the way, counsel's reference to her asking for gum, that's not what the evidence is. The evidence is that she informed John Doe that she had just vomited, and he offered her a stick of gum and then had sex with her. So all of these people around her are concerned. They can, and most of them are sober, and they can see that she's incapacitated. The one person who says that she wasn't is John Doe, who had sex with her.
We've come to the end of your time. I do have one probably irrelevant question. But the policy prohibits sexual contact without effective consent or where the other individual is incapacitated. Is the second part of that redundant? I mean, can't you not, I mean, or does it add something? And if it does add something, what does it add to the prohibition of sexual contact without effective consent?
It would be less obviously redundant, Your Honor, if the word effective wasn't in there, because then it would imply that consent.
Right.
Right. I would say that I'm not sure, standing here, that there is a distinction worth any difference, but I would agree with the Court that any distinction there could be or there isn't is not relevant for purposes of
this case. And in terms of the adequacy of notice to a student who is charged with violating the policy, I don't remember now. Was John Doe charged specifically with having sexual contact with an individual who was incapacitated or with someone who couldn't give effective consent, or both? Or was he just generally charged with violating the policy?
No, it was both, and it was express written notice
and identified both.
It was two charges: one non-consensual sexual contact, and sexual assault, which are defined differently under the but with someone who had not given consent and was incapacitated.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
To answer your question, Justice Perlis, the result is the absurd finding we have here, where the adjudicator finds that she was actually giving consent, we have the text message, but that at the same time she didn't have the capacity to give consent, even though she had the capacity to give the text messages, was acting of her own volition, and so you have this she's giving consent, but it doesn't count because she didn't have capacity because she's intoxicated. They're equating intoxication with incapacitation. I don't think any of this, maybe one or two of the witnesses used the word incapacitation, which, you know, isn't really a lay term, but the intoxication, clearly they were both drunk. John Doe did say, if you read his closing statement, I think even his little opening statement that he had zero time to prepare for, that both of them were intoxicated, but he had capacity, wasn't incapacitated, took responsibility for his behavior, even though he said truthfully that he didn't remember any of it, or had very little recollection of it, just as she did. She was never unconscious. She was always conscious. She was walking. She had enough agency to make to create a ruse to get back to his room. She knew why she was going back to his room. She knew where she was going. She knew why she was going there. All of those meet the policy definition of capacity because she knows the who, what, where, why, and how of the sexual activity. It's only later, the behavior that she doesn't quite remember all of it, that it becomes an issue.
Right, but then the question, which goes to my question, is it's not necessarily effective consent. If there is some difference there.
It's gone from there's been a consent, then effective consent, affirmative consent. There's other combinations of those terms, but effective consent, I don't know what notice. The provision where that exists that would give students notice says somebody who doesn't understand the who, what, where, and why of the sexual activity. And he's faced with someone who's texting him, do you have a condom? The only reason she says condom, because when he says get back here, is see, no, there's an arrangement to go back there and have sex. With who? With him. Where? In his room. When? In 2 minutes. How? However they did it. In fact, she even recalls the oral sex. And then it's only later that you don't quite remember the sexual intercourse, and friends find out, and there were witnesses, and in other words, it took a week or two, and some political pressure, I would say, before she finally acknowledged that it was wrong, or it was inappropriate. The cross-examination, the hearing, the reason why the cases have not actually hit the reported cases on the substantial evidence test versus independent review is until now most of the cases deal solely with there's an unfair hearing. And in an unfair hearing, the court need not look at the evidence, because why look at the product of something you know is unfair? And that's what has occurred, and that's what occurred in this instance. We're weighing feathers one more feather, and then he wins. And the investigator did not comply with the policy, did not tie in the raw evidence to the violation, and did not provide a fair hearing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both counsel very much. The cause will stand submitted, and we are in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.